senior populations in Dillingham as well as in other communities throughout the state are growing at a phenomenal rate.
The impact of Alaska's aging population on rural communities. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state lawmakers consider a plan to revise state retirement benefits.
It's like backwards. It seems to implicitly undermine worker retention.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
Alaska has the fastest growing senior population in the country. That demographic trend is playing out across the state, and in rural places like Dillingham, the growth of the older population is amplified by the fact that the younger working age group is simultaneously shrinking. KDLG's Dacia Eaton has the story as part of our Changing Faces of Alaska series.
Catherine Chocknock lives in New Stewyahawk. She's 68, and for most of her life, she was a commercial fisherman for Peter Pan Cannery.
I used to commercial fish for 33 years. We fish in Africa.
Today, she's eating the senior lunch with her husband in the cafeteria at the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation.
Corn on the cob and chicken noodle soup.
Chocknock has a gauze patch on her left eye. She's in Dillingham visiting Kanakanak Hospital for a problem with her eye. She says she wants to stay independent as long as possible. But like many elders in nearby villages, she's considering moving to Dillingham to be closer to medical care and senior services. People like Catherine are becoming more the norm in Dillingham than the exception. The city estimates that there are now around 300 people over 65 in Dillingham, a town of just over a couple thousand people. Over the past decade or so, there was also a significant drop in 25 to 59-year-olds. Another sign of the shift, locals have been selling off their fishing permits. Researchers call it a graying of the fleet. The senior population in southwest Alaska has increased by almost 40% in the last 10 years. The trend isn't surprising to Denise Daniello, the executive director of the Alaska Commission on Aging, an agency under the Department of Health and Social Services.
Alaska is the state with the fastest growing senior population, and senior populations in Dillingham as well as in other communities throughout the state are growing at a phenomenal rate.
According to the 2010 census, there are more than 90,000 people aged 60 and over in Alaska. In a state of less than 750,000 people, that means about 13% of Alaska's population are now becoming seniors. That's less than the U.S. average, which is 18.5%, but Alaska is considered to have the fastest growing senior population in the U.S. compared to its total population. People like Catherine make up some of that growth. But statewide, the growing older population also has to do with the big influx of people who moved to Alaska for good in the 70s, the baby boomers. Alaska has traditionally been one of the states with the lowest percentage of seniors, primarily because before the boomers, many people moved away after they retired. But the boomers changed that, Daniello says, deciding to stay in Alaska to grow old.
During the 1970s and 80s, it was those young people who came here to work on the pipeline, and there were also a lot of other jobs, too, that were related to the economic boom during those years, and they fell in love with the state. They settled, they raised families, built homes, and they're still living here.
Alice Ruby is the mayor of Dillingham. She says she started noticing something census people call churning in Dillingham about 5 years ago.
Even though, you know, our larger hub communities didn't seem to be growing, there was churning going on where upwardly mobile folks were leaving, but they were being replaced by folks moving in from the villages to get more access to services.
Ruby is herself a baby boomer, and she walks with a cane. She says she's acutely aware that just as more older people seem to be moving into Dillingham, there are fewer services because of the downturn in the economy and state and federal budget cuts. The Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation just laid off their palliative care coordinator this spring and has not replaced her. And Dillingham Senior Center, which flooded over last New Year's Eve when a pipe broke, has been closed most of the year. Mayor Ruby says some things need to change in Dillingham, but getting to the senior services might take a while, since the city is so overwhelmed with critical infrastructure projects that take precedence. That's not what residents like Bernice Hyanna want to hear. Her family has recently started taking care of her father, John Bennett Sr., an 85-year-old who spent his life commercial fishing in Bristol Bay. Every day she spends her lunch break looking in on him at his one-story house just outside town.
But how are you?
All right.
You're all right?
Hyanna says her dad developed emphysema, then Alzheimer's symptoms a few years ago when his wife died, and he needs full-time supervision. Now Hyanna is faced with her aunt and uncle also coming home to Dillingham to grow old.
She and her husband live in Flagstaff, Arizona, and recently we became aware that they're unable to handle their own matters, and so my sister is going to Flagstaff this week to pack them up and move them back to Dillingham.
See you after work, huh?
Yeah. Who?
Me.
Across town at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Bristol Bay campus, Carolyn Smith, an assistant professor of allied health, is training personal care attendants, or PCAs, something she says all indicators say Dillingham and the rest of the state are going to need a whole lot more of soon.
It is the number one hot growth because of the aging population. It's because of people like myself who are moving on into that age group.
Are you a baby boomer?
I sure am.
And private industry also sees a market. Recently, the first personal care attendant satellite office for ResCare, which provides in-home care mostly for elders, opened in Dillingham. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The state Senate today got an update on the state employee retirement system's unfunded liability. It's now $11 billion. The State Affairs Committee also began a series of hearings on a new plan that would allow workers to choose which type of retirement plan they want. APRN's Dave Donaldson has more.
With a defined benefits plan, an employee knows exactly what income and benefits will become available after retirement. Defined contributions means that employee knows how much money will go into a retirement account with no promise of its value or how long it will last after state service. The state currently offers new hires the defined contributions plan, having changed from the benefits approach 5 years ago. But the bill by Juneau Democrat Dennis Egan would set up a new defined benefits plan and make it available to new employees and to those who were hired when there was no option. Jesse Keel, chief of staff to the bill's sponsor, explained the new level of employment benefits and the newly structured plan.
The new tier created by Senate Bill 121 is designed to be less costly than previous defined benefit tiers and more predictable, Mr. Chairman, more stable than some of the previous tiers, especially our initial attempts after statehood at creating a pension system. The new tier should provide us with fewer surprises down the road. That's part of its design.
Actuary William Fornia, who's worked with state retirement plans throughout the nation and has worked with Alaska's plan directly, advocates offering the new plan for employees' consideration. He mentioned the risk to employees of having to manage their retirement accounts themselves and to Alaska's singular position as the largest employer in the United States, commercial or government, that does not have a Social Security-type plan in place in case of plan failures. He said Alaska opted out of the Social Security system for state workers some 30 years ago. Unions and many career employees have said that the state is facing a problem with worker retention, and Fornia says the retirement plan fits into that problem. Defined benefits are usually the choice of experienced workers who need to look ahead toward retirement. Defined contributions plans are portable from job to job, generally preferred by younger workers or those who don't want a career.
So by having a defined contribution vehicle as their only retirement vehicle, you implicitly are encouraging them to work, you know, 5-10 years and then go retire someplace that has a retirement plan. It's like backwards. It seems to implicitly undermine worker retention.
The Parnell administration opposes the new plan. Deputy Commissioner of Administration Mike Barnhill said oil production has been decreasing over the years, and the state's not ready to make any long-term commitments.
Until we can put this state back on a stable fiscal path, we believe it's imprudent to make promises that could last 70 to 80 years. And the worst thing in my mind, Mr. Chair, is that we extend those promises and then 70 years from now, another unfunded liability arises in the new plan, and we don't have the kind of general fund resources that we have today to backstop that.
The committee will meet on the proposed plan in Fairbanks next month, and we'll hear more testimony during the session that begins in January. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The National Snow and Ice Data Center says Arctic sea ice melted this summer to the second lowest level since scientists started keeping records more than 50 years ago. The amount of ice covering the Arctic hit its lowest point late last week. Scientists calculate 1.67 million square miles of ice. Only in 2007 was there less summer sea ice, which has been dramatically declining since scientists began using satellites to monitor melt in 1979. Other records go back to 1953. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the potential for unearthing valuable strategic minerals in Alaska.
Chromite, cobalt, fluorspar, gallium.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Kluckwan Incorporated closed its Haines office late last week. The board of directors for the Native Corporation met over the weekend, and there is a possibility they could reopen the office at a later date. No other details were available at this time, but shareholders have expressed discomfort in how the corporation has recently handled the funds in its three trusts and corporate operations. Shareholders also voted to partially liquidate the largest of those three funds earlier this year. Some beneficiaries say they have not yet received the full distribution from that decision. Governor Sean Parnell and Senator Lisa Murkowski are among the top state and federal leaders who've been invited to Fairbanks for a meeting on how Alaska could provide minerals that are essential to industry and national security. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
You may never have heard of a few dozen substances that 21st century industry increasingly depends on.
Chromite, cobalt, fluorspar, gallium.
That's Bob Swenson, a state geologist and director of the State Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys here in Fairbanks, and he's leading an effort to find those exotic-sounding substances in Alaska, without which our high-tech world couldn't function. So it's important to know where those minerals and elements can be found. And as it happens, a lot of them are here in Alaska. That's why the governor's office, along with the State Department of Natural Resources and UAF, have put together the Alaska Strategic and Critical Minerals Summit to be held September 30th at the Princess Riverside Lodge here in Fairbanks. Swenson is helping organize the event, the first of its kind in Alaska.
I think it is an important meeting, and it is bringing together a lot of the leaders on critical and strategic minerals activities actually around the globe.
Swenson will be among the presenters at the summit, along with Parnell and Murkowski, and an assistant secretary of the Federal Department of Energy, and the director of the U.S. Geological Survey's Minerals Program. Some top UAF administrators and academics involved in research and mining and geological engineering also will be among the presenters.
I think it's important that we make sure that we have as many of the different entities that are involved in this type of activity in the state in the same room as we can and hear what everybody has to say about the potential as well as the hurdles that face specifically strategic minerals, including rare earth elements.
Rare earth elements are a group of light and heavy metals used in all kinds of electronic applications, from cell phones to hybrid vehicles to wind generators, and military hardware, such as night vision scopes and missile guidance systems.
A that's been a major focus in both the Department of Energy as well as the U.S. Geological Survey, to identify all the different commodities, mineral commodities, that are in use in the U.S. that may have either limited supply or that supply is at risk.
Rare earth elements are high on the list of critical mineral supplies at risk because of sharp restrictions on exports of processed rare earths by China. The Chinese have a virtual monopoly on rare earths mining and processing and have been using that both to jack up prices and as a trade weapon, most recently against Japan. That has focused worldwide attention on the issue and compelled Murkowski and other U.S. lawmakers to promote legislation that would mandate a crash program at the federal level to promote a U.S. rare earths supply chain. Alaska would figure in such a program. The state already has one rare earths mining operation at Bokan Mountain near Ketchikan. Executives with Ucor Rare Metals, the company operating Bokan Mountain, will talk about that during the summit. Swenson will talk about a state program launched this summer to inventory known rare earths deposits around Alaska. Steve Burrell, the executive director of the Alaska Miners Association and another presenter at the summit, says the state's inventory will help government and industry identify other promising rare earths prospects here in the state.
There are more than a dozen minerals that this country is 100% dependent on foreign sources. Many, many of those we know to exist in Alaska.
In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The controversial proposed halibut catch-sharing plan from the National Marine Fisheries Service has caused a rift in Homer between the town's commercial and charter halibut industries. Nowhere was that rift more visible than at Monday night's meeting of the Homer City Council. KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports.
At issue Monday night was a resolution before the Homer City Council that would have directed the city manager to write a letter to NIMS and the U.S. Secretary of Commerce requesting a new socioeconomic impact study be completed before any action is taken regarding the halibut catch-sharing plan. Before the regular meeting began, Councilmember Kevin Hogan came out strongly against the resolution, saying the proposed halibut catch-sharing plan was none of the city's business.
Welcome to the world of federal regulation, you know. The commercial industry has been living with this monster for 15, 16, 17 years now, and the resource needs to be managed biologically and professionally, and that's what this plan is about. It has nothing to do with the city of Homer.
Council member Brian Zack is the one who proposed the resolution, and he disagreed with Hogan. He pointed out that local halibut charter operators were hit last year with new limited entry regulations and are now faced with a catch-sharing plan that would likely reduce their bag limit from 2 fish per angler to 1.
It affects Homer. It affects us as a community in Alaska, a remote community. That's what I'm just hoping for, is that we give that opportunity at least tonight for people to be heard. And then, in addition to that, that we actually do follow up with some action.
Dozens of people made themselves heard at Monday night's meeting on both sides of the issue in public testimony that went on for an hour and a half. Jerry Martin, along with her husband Jim, runs North Country Halibut Charters. She said that this year her company collected nearly $50,000 in city and borough taxes.
In these economic times, I would think that the city needs this sales tax revenue as much as I need my livelihood. We need your support to save our industry, and we hope you'll consider this resolution. Thank you.
Many people in the crowd Monday night were commercial fishermen and their families. Buck Lakaitis, chairman of the North Pacific Fisheries Association, told council members that meddling in fish politics is not their job.
With all due respect, you're not qualified to make these decisions. I mean, you're very intelligent people, but this is not the venue to make these decisions. I seriously wonder if you've read, 295 pages of an environmental assessment.
Jenny Espenshade told council members that she is torn between the commercial fishing interests of her family and the interests of her longtime friends in the charter business. She admitted she didn't fully understand the catch-sharing issue.
What I do understand is community. If we let this issue tear this community apart, it will.
Homer is a very diverse community. Its economy is very diverse. So as you address this issue, if you can help our friends and neighbors in distress, by all means do so. But please do so in a way that values the diversity of our community and our economy.
In the end, the City Council voted 4-2 against Zach's resolution, with only Howard and Zach in support. The deadline for public comment on the NIMFS cat-sharing plan is September 21st. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
A nonprofit in Anchorage is the first organization in Alaska that can receive donations by text message. Beans Cafe and the Children's Lunchbox are now able to receive cash through mobile giving. Ken Miller is the development director for Beans and the Children's Lunchbox. He says millions were raised in a short time by text giving to the Haiti Relief Fund. He says at that time, mobile giving was under the purview of large organizations.
And then smaller nonprofits began to utilize the services. It's very economical to get into. And what it gives the opportunity for the nonprofit to do is to get small donations from a different group than maybe their most common individual that they've been giving donations from in the past. It's a much younger, it's the crowd that's comfortable with text donation and mobile giving.
It's a simple process. You text a keyword to a number.
And the keyword for Beans Cafe, for example, is beans, B-E-A-N-S. And I would text that word to 50555. If I wanted to make a donation to the Children's Lunchbox, I would very simply text in K-I-D-D-O, which stands for kiddo, to 50555.
Once you've done that, a message asks you to confirm your $10 donation. If you do, the donation gets added to your mobile carrier bill. Miller says they'll get all but about 30 cents of each donation, and a person can donate up to 3 times. He says no other nonprofits in the state have used this fundraising method yet, but he thinks it would help out others beyond Beans. The transactions are handled by an outside company. Miller stresses a $10 donation goes a long way when it only costs Beans about $1.20 to provide a full meal.
You have an opportunity to serve 7-8 individuals a hot meal and provide services, whether it's social services, whether it's transportation services, whether it's just shelter during the day and night to an individual in the community that's in need.
Beans Cafe serves between 400 and 500 lunchtime meals each day. You can also help out the Children's Lunchbox program this weekend by donating food at the Spinard Farmers Market on Saturday. The U.S. Justice Department has announced that it is handing out more than $118 million to American Indian and Alaska Native tribes and organizations. Several in Alaska are receiving some of that money. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
Tribal organizations in Alaska are getting over $13.2 million. The money is being used for a number of initiatives, including for alcohol and substance abuse, preventing violence against women, and tribal youth programs. The Bristol Bay Native Association is getting the largest grant award in Alaska at over $1.9 million. The CEO of BBNA is Ralph Anderson. He confirms the money will be used to help fund a handful of programs.
Our Violence Against Women program will be receiving funding under that granting program as well. We have received a couple of, I believe this is village public safety officers, positions through that grant. We'll also be undertaking tribal courts training program or developing a program through that grant as well.
Anderson reported that there are a number of tribes active in the tribal court process, including the Chogyang tribe in Dillingham and the Togiak Traditional Council.
What we're hoping to do is to expand the tribal court opportunities to as many tribes as we can. And we see this as one way of, or an opportunity to at least begin getting tribes and or assisting tribes to get their tribal court systems in place.
The new grants to American Indian and Alaska Native tribal organizations is part of the Justice Department's new streamlined grant application system for federal funding. The Coordinated Tribal Assistance Solicitation basically allows tribal organizations to file a single application for existing grant programs administered by the Justice Department's Office of Justice Programs, Community-Oriented Policing Services, and the Office of Violence Against Women. Anderson is pleased the Justice Department has tried to simplify things for tribal organizations like BBNA.
It's the first year for us, for BBNA. We missed the opportunity previously because we just weren't aware of it.
The $1.9 million in grant funding for BBNA is a big boost for the organization, but Anderson says perhaps more important is the boost the money will provide for the Bristol Bay region.
Also pleased about $1.9 million dollars coming into our region, especially during, if you consider or and look at the national picture where budget deficits and debt ceilings and those kinds of things are really are front and center with the high unemployment rate nationally up around 9%. I'm just pleased that we're able to bring in nearly $2 million to help in our local economy.
Other tribal organizations receiving funding from the Justice Department includes the Alaska Native Justice Center, which is getting $490,000, and the Association of Village Council Presidents, which is getting over $1.2 million. Additionally, the Kwikset IRA Council is getting over $383,000, and the Native Village of Nulato is getting over $954,000. All told, over $118 million is going to nearly 150 American Indian and Alaska Native organizations across the country. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you've missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Mike Mason in Dillingham, Tara Bicknell in Haines, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.